Philip Carlo is back on the show today. Phil was on with me last year for a book he wrote about pedophiles and priests called Predators and Prayers. Now he's back with a new book called The Iceman, Confessions of a Mafia Contract Killer. It is about Richard Kuklinski, who was nicknamed the Iceman, who was a hitman for the mob and who carried out more than 200 murders before being locked up. Phil, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Paul. Good to be back.
Always a pleasure having you on here. You actually went to prison and talked to this guy face-to-face, didn't you?
Well, yes. I spent actually a lot of time in Trenton State Prison with Kuklinski, over 240 hours, actually. It's funny. The last time we did the show, I was in the process of interviewing him still, and then I finished the book, and it recently came out.
So when you're sitting there and you're looking into a cold-blooded killer's eyes, do they look different than your eyes or mine?
Dead shark, man. White shark, absolutely. You know, you and I talked a little bit last time about Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, and we discussed that very issue. Yes, they're absolutely dead. This is dead, like a white shark's eyes. It's like marble, looking at marble. Psychopaths, I think, are missing something, are missing several human elements: compassion, empathy, sympathy, a conscience. They don't have a conscience. And you see that in the eyes. It ends up manifesting in the eyes, for sure, man, like a white shark.
And when you talk about a psychopath, this guy certainly qualifies because he actually enjoyed killing, didn't he?
Well, you know, it was that and a combination of different things. In all fairness to the situation, to the story, as it were, this was Richard was severely abused as a child. His father regularly knocked him out. His father used to wrap a garrison belt around his fist and punch him in the body so he wouldn't leave marks. And he took the hitting him in the head and then knocking him out. His father murdered his brother in front of him. When Richard was almost five, his brother was beaten to death by his father in front of him, his brother Florian, and they laid the little body out in the funeral parlor, not in the funeral parlor, in the living room, in a cheap pine coffin, and that was Richard's first experience with death, and he didn't quite understand why Florian wasn't waking up, and he kept talking to Florian in his head, and Florian never woke up, and this is really true, this really truly happened. The parents got away with the murder by saying that the kid had fallen down the stairs and broke his neck, and it was back in the 1930s. There was not the system set up now for child abuse, and the authorities believed it. And really, Richard never spoke about it until I started talking with him. You know, what I always do, Paul, as I mentioned to you last time, I don't talk about the crimes first. It seems to me the crimes are the byproduct of something else, always. When they're that extreme, when they're that bad, there's got to be underpinnings that beget a mental attitude, a psychosis, if you will, that enables a person like Kuklinski to do what he was doing. Just so your listeners know what we're talking about here, he actually fed live human beings to rats at a point in time. These were contract murders. It was mandated that the mark be tortured, and Richard devised this way of torturing people, and he actually filmed it. Now, he did this later on in his career, for want of a better word. He'd been killing people already for 25 years, and he actually filmed his doing that for two reasons, he told me. One was to show the people that ordered the murders that the guy suffered. And two, which I found very interesting, he said to me that he filmed it so he could study the films and get his own reaction to it. And he said he had no reaction at all. He was able to just sit there and watch it and feel no kind of empathy, no kind of sympathy for somebody under those unbelievably horrible conditions. In fact, at a point in time, he did drawings of people being eaten alive by rats, and he gave me a couple of those drawings, which we wound up publishing in the book. And I said, well, you know, did you learn anything from it? Did you learn anything about yourself from it? He said, yeah, I learned that I needed help, psychiatric help. I said, well, you know, did you get any? He said, well, what was I supposed to do, go to a psychiatrist and tell them I enjoy killing people? And so he never did seek any help. But this whole thing of him kind of self-analyzing himself over something so amazingly barbaric, so amazingly medieval. In fact, HBO, I think you mentioned, did three documentaries on Kuklinski's life. And it was the last one they did, the Iceman and the Psychiatrist, that I'd seen, I believe it was 2002, that made me interested in the case. And in that piece, he described doing what I just told you. And I know about serial killers. I've written books about them. I've interviewed many of them. And when I heard him describing that, my jaw hung open. And I wrote him a letter that night, and we started communicating with one another, and ultimately I wrote really the definitive book on the life and crimes of Richard Kuklinski.
Yeah, that's what Iceman certainly is. And my jaw was dropped as I was reading your description of his description of what happened, taking this guy to that cave and having the
oh, you,
the
yeah,
rats
you,
do
you
that.
Read the introduction?
Yeah. Oh, I read most of the book. But that one was, I mean, you started off with quite a shocker there.
I know. It was actually, and it's true. It was just like that. And then him going home to his family, which we need to let your listeners understand. This guy was married with children. He put his all his children to Catholic school, and I know them all now. The two daughters are 40 and 41. The son is 38, and they're lovely, wonderful people. I spent many, many hours interviewing them, especially the daughters, because they experienced a lot of his psychosis. I mean, he never hit his children, but he did beat on his wife. He had a empirical temper. He threw things. He tore the kitchen sink off the wall. He tore the kitchen cabinets off the wall. There was a table. By the way, we're talking about a man who's nearly 6'6", and when I was interviewing him, he was 320 pounds. While he was free, he was about 290, a very, very big, powerful Polish individual. And there was a marble table. They had a marble dining table that took four men to bring into the house and put in place. He lost his temper one day. He picked up this table and he threw it out the front window effortlessly. So we're talking about an individual that has superhuman strength, which might even be a fusion of his psychosis. They say that insane people can be very strong, and people in a particular kind of rage can have superhuman strength. And he apparently very much had that. And the thought of this guy focusing on you and stalking you and intent upon killing you is chilling beyond description. My intention in writing this book was not to just write about the murders, the crimes. My intention and what I did was go into his childhood, how he became that way, all his early experiences that pointed towards, in a sense, becoming the literal monster that he ended up becoming.
It's the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX, talking with Philip Carlo. The book is The Iceman, Confessions of a Mafia Contract Killer. You mentioned his wife and his kids, who never knew about this double life, right?
No, they had no idea. And that's what made it so bizarre to me. As the story unfolded, as a result of my research, I was kind of astounded that he was married, that he had a lovely wife. She has amazing poise. She's very well spoken. In fact, Monday we did the Larry King show. I think you might know that. And I was on Larry King for the full hour with his wife. And the viewers were just blown away by her poise. And
what did she think that he was doing for a living?
Well, you know, he told her he had several different businesses. He was buying out different warehouses and sellouts and discounting sweaters, selling wholesale jeans and sweaters to flea markets. She thought he was doing that, but what he really was doing, he, as well as being a contract murderer, he had a team of hijackers. So the materials that he was selling, she thought he was buying and selling legally. He was selling swag out of warehouses to people in flea markets across the country. And they all knew they were buying hot stuff, but they didn't care. So the next time you go to a flea market, you might be suspect of what you're buying. Of course, often that stuff is cheap because it was stolen at somewhere.
Yep.
And he had a hijack ring. And ultimately, she grew to accept that. And he really wasn't the kind of guy you questioned, and she told me that repeatedly. She's a big woman. She's 5'10", but he broke her nose twice. He broke her ribs four times, and she learned to make the best of a terrible, terrible, terrible situation.
What was his connection to John Gotti and the Gambino family and Sammy the Bull Gravano? These were all part of his world, right?
Right. Very, very good question, Paul. As always, you cut to the nuggets. In the course of him becoming a contract killer, it all began in Jersey City, New Jersey, where he was brought up. And right next door to Jersey is Hoboken, New Jersey, which was filled with mafia people. When he was a teenager, he started working for, actually when he was about 19, he did his first murder for somebody in the mafia, and one thing led to another, and he started ultimately becoming a contract killer for them. At a point in time when he first got married, when he first married Barbara, he swore off crime, he got a straight job, and he was working in a film lab. And one of the things the film lab did was, it was a legitimate film lab on 8th Avenue here in New York, was they developed porno movies for different porno companies. So he had all these this pornography coming in there, and they were making duplications from the masters. And he ended up meeting people who were peripherally involved with the Gambino family, because they are involved in pornography. They still are, in fact. And little by little, he started meeting more and more people that were connected to the mafia. And ultimately, he had a run-in with a guy named Roy DeMeo, who was an extremely interesting individual. He ran a crew out of the Gemini Lounge in Canarsie, Brooklyn. And it is, law enforcement acknowledges that this crew killed over 200 people. And Richard ended up working on behalf of Roy DeMeo, doing special jobs that required traveling, special jobs that required finesse, special jobs that he didn't allocate to his crew of killers. This guy was literally running a crew of five serial killers. Richard was a lone wolf. Richard worked by himself. He didn't like working with other people. He did on occasion, but he didn't like it. And through Roy DeMeo and the excellence of, for want of a better word, of Richard's work, he was introduced to Sammy Gravano, to John Gotti, and he did work for them. And ultimately, Gravano asked him to kill a cop at a point in time, and Richard didn't know the individual as a cop, but he would have killed him anyway. He didn't like cops. For the policemen listening out there, I know this is upsetting to you, but it's just really what happened. He viewed cops as bullies with guns, because Jersey City was a very crooked municipality, and most of the cops there were, in fact, crooked. I mean, they became fact later on. Many of them were arrested. Judges were arrested. It was a big scandal. So his early experience with the police was not a good one, and he came to believe all cops were like that. And he'd kill a cop in a second. I know he killed two cops before he was asked to kill Calavo. So to make a long story short, he did this murder, and he later spoke about that on HBO 10 years later. And after he admitted to that murder, the Jersey police went to Trenton State Prison to ask him who ordered the hit. Initially, he didn't want to tell, but ultimately, he told them that Sammy Gravano ordered the hit. He felt no allegiance towards Gravano anymore, because Gravano ratted out John Gotti. So this is really becomes interesting. The federal government knew that Gravano ordered the murder of a cop, but the federal government could not give Gravano a deal to walk if he testified against John Gotti. So they said, look, you didn't tell us about this murder. We don't know what happened. They couldn't give a cop killer a deal, because every PD in the country would have been up in arms. The newspapers would have been, everyone would have been angry beyond, as they rightly should be. So they acted like they didn't know about the murder, and they let him testify against Gotti, and testify against multiple other people. In the end, he put away 43 mafiosa, and all the while he was lying. In other words, the first thing he had to do when he took the stand in all those trials was say, I'm Sammy Gravano, I committed 19 murders, and I'm here, and yada, yada, yada. And then he testified, but he actually committed 20 murders, and the federal government knew it, and they hid it. In other words, they protected the cop killer, and they gave a cop killer the freedom. Mm. And it's really coming out just now for the first time. And I found out through sources that I have in different jurisdictions that this is really what happened, and it's an absolute disgrace.
I got to take a break. We'll come back and talk more with Phil Carlo. The book is a terrific read. It's The Iceman, Confessions of a Mafia Contract Killer. I would not say it qualifies as light summer reading for the kids, but if you're into these sort of stories and you want to hear what it's like to be inside the mind of a guy who does this for a living, you got to pick this book up, The Iceman. We're back in a moment on The Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX. For most of us, our only connection to the mafia, to the mob, is watching The Sopranos on HBO, or movies like Goodfellas and The Godfather, Donnie Brasco, or even Analyze This. That's the closest we're ever going to come to a mafioso. But Phil Carlo got to know Richard Kuklinski, a mafia hitman, pretty well. He spent over 240 hours doing face-to-face interviews with Kuklinski, also known as the Iceman, a guy who worked for the mob and killed for the mob, and it seems to me at times also killed for his own pleasure, as I'm reading through the book. How high up in the mafia was this guy? I don't know what the different levels are. You actually have some written out at the front of the book here, but it doesn't say which level he had risen to.
Well, Paul, he was known as an independent contractor. And because he was a non-Italian, he was able to work for the different families without conflict. Once you're inducted into any given family, you can only work for that family unless they lend you out, as it were. But Richard, because he was Polish, was able to work for all seven of the East Coast families. Regarding The Sopranos, that whole television show is based upon the De Cavalcante family, which were located in Hoboken, and that's who Richard first started murdering for. When he was 19 years old, he got a job to do a hit, and he did it, and he did it well. They gave him a second job, and when they gave him that second job, they told him, you know, after he got the job, the guy he was talking to was like, he called them meatballs. I said, well, why do you call them meatballs? He said, well, he was round like a meatball. He had a head shaped like a meatball, so his nickname was Meatballs. So he said, well, you know, the meatball said to bring back a piece of him. So I said, well, what do you mean a piece of him? And he said, well, you know, a piece of him so I could show it to the guy that wanted this done, that it was done. So Richard said, oh, you know, okay, I'll bring back a piece of him. And he's thinking these Italians are nuts. So he grabbed the guy. The guy worked in a used car lot, and he made believe that he was trying to buy a car. And they went for a drive together to test the car. And Richard has his car parked on an industrial street that was kind of desolated. And he pulled over there, and he said, can I look under the hood? So this car drives great. Let me just look. Not that I'm a mechanic. I don't really know, but let me take a look. So the guy said, sure. So they both got out of the car. The car salesman opened the hood, and while he was looking in there, Richard smacked him in the head with a blackjack, knocked him out, took him many miles to a forest, bound him to a tree, and proceeded to do what he was asked to do. This job also required torture. So when he was finished with this hapless man, he buried what was left of him, and he had a part of him. And he put the part of him he had in a bag, and he went back to this guy to show that he did the job. So he knocks on the door, and he's got this bag in his hand. And the guy says, you're back already? He says, yeah. He says, you got something to show me? He says, yeah, I do. He says, right here. He puts the bag on the table. The guy opens the bag. Big smile spreads on his face. He reaches in. Richard took the guy's head, picked up the guy's head out of the bag. And so he says, he looks at Richard and he says, son of a B, you're a rare man, I see. And from that day on, his relationship was cemented with that family.
You know, you talk about him dumping the bodies in the forest. There are so many things in this book where I went, oh, my God.
Yeah, I know.
As I'm reading this. But at one point, he can't go to one forest anymore to bury any more bodies because he's afraid that the police may have seen him on his many, many trips to that forest before.
One of the things he did was he purposely used different police jurisdictions. We're talking here about a very clever man. He's thinking things out. He's plotting. He's planning. He's stalking. It wasn't unusual for him to wait 5 days a week, 10 days, 2 weeks following somebody to find the opportunity that would be most suitable to do what he needed to do. He regularly did that. In fact, he was more or less a professional stalker. The murder always came at the end of a long series of many hours of sitting, waiting, watching. He had several different vans that he used. He had tinted windows. He had cases of soda in the van. He had a way to go to the bathroom in the van, so he didn't have to get out of the van once he was in position. And he had his weapons. He had an incredible repertoire of weapons. He used everything you can think of to kill people, and that was one of the reasons why all his initial murders were never tied to him. As you know, when he was a young man, he killed about 40 people just for the fun of it under the West Side Highway in Manhattan, which, if for people that don't know, the West Side Highway back then was very desolate at night, and it was filled with different hobos and bums. And he went over there, and he started killing those men just for looking at him crooked or asking for money too aggressively. And he kind of made it his own personal killing ground, and that's where he learned how to kill so well. I mean, please understand that when I say so well, I'm not saying it like I think he was doing a good thing.
Yeah, there's no admiration here for this man or his deeds.
I mean, he developed his proficiency, as it were, there. For instance, he developed a way to kill people that on his own. No one taught him this. He took to using a hunting knife and sticking it in the back of people's skulls in an upward angle. As you know, you read the book, and they would die very quickly, and there would be little blood. He came to think that blood was the issue, was a big problem, because once you had blood all over you, people noticed you. So he took to wearing dark colors, and he kept trying to find ways where he could do the murder quickly, and there would be little blood. Gunshot was good, but the gun makes noises. Knives were good, but the knives cause a lot of blood. If you cut somebody's throat, it squirts out all over the place. So he developed this method of getting behind somebody, holding them in place with his superhuman power, his arm wrapped around the neck, and putting the knife in on an angle up, and they would shake for a bit and they'd be dead. And he told me if he left the knife in for a couple of minutes, or a minute as it were, there would be no blood at all. He just drew the knife out, and he saved his knives. He notched his knives. The day he was arrested, he had a knife in a briefcase in the trunk of his car, and he had 14 notches in that one knife. And I saw the knife. I saw photographs of it, and I was like, holy smoke. So I said to him, the day you were arrested, you had a knife on you with 14 notches on it. Did you carry that with you, like, you know, all your life or something? How long were you carrying that knife, Richard? And he says, oh, no, I had dozens of knives. I used to throw them away when they got too notched. Now, I know this might sound fanciful and not believable, but it's exactly what happened. We're talking about here an individual that killed as easily as somebody spitting on the sidewalk. You mentioned before that he killed for money, but he also killed when people annoyed him. There was a time, for instance, he was driving over the George Washington Bridge. He was coming home from a murder he had just committed, a contract killing, and there was a hapless guy standing there, a hitchhiker, with his thumb out. And Richard just passed him by, and they looked at one another for a moment, and the guy's thumb turned into the finger, and he gave Richard the finger. And that, for some reason, incensed him. Always since he was a young man, he couldn't deal with people giving him the finger. He went all the way around and came back. He had a .38 with him. He lowered the window. It was on the passenger side. He slowed up as he was driving. He looked in the rearview mirror. He made sure that the moment was right. And just when he came in line with the guy, he shot him, and he hit him right in the chest, and he killed him. And that murder obviously was never tied to Richard because it was so happenstance. But this is the type of... And then he went home, you know, put on the television, cracked a beer, had a sandwich. His wife greeted him when he walked in the door, and nobody was the wiser.
Unbelievable. Phil, let me take a break here. We'll come back. We'll talk more about this guy, Richard Kuklinski, who you profile in The Iceman, Confessions of a Mafia Contract Killer. And there are allegations of him being involved with the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, which we'll get into next on the Paul Harris Show on KMOX. Talking with Philip Carlo. Several years ago, I had a bestseller called The Night Stalker about serial killer Richard Ramirez. Last year, we talked about his book Predators and Prayers about pedophile priests. Now his new book is The Iceman, Confessions of a Mafia Contract Killer, about Richard Kuklinski, a guy who was responsible for over 200 murders and really might have been involved in the Jimmy Hoffa disappearance, Phil?
Well, you know, there's a whole big controversy surrounding all of that. And if I may, I'd love to tell your listeners what I learned. Basically, this is how it came about. During my researching this story, I interviewed Lieutenant Pat Kane, who was the Jersey state trooper that was responsible for Richard being brought down. He pursued Richard for 5 years and ultimately was directly responsible for Richard being arrested and sent away to jail for numerous life sentences. To make a long story short, during my interviews with Pat Kane, he mentioned that Kuklinski might have something to do with the killing of Hoffa. I said, really, why are you saying that? He said, well, there's rumors in the street in Jersey City and in Hoboken, and I know for a fact that Kuklinski knew Tony Provenzano when they were kids together back in Jersey City. So Tony, everyone knows Tony Provenzano, maybe everyone doesn't know, but Tony Provenzano is generally thought to be the man that was responsible for the murder of Hoffa. So when I heard that, I thought this was kind of interesting. And the next time I went back to Trenton State Prison to interview Richard, and now I'd been interviewing him for many, many hours, we kind of developed a rapport. And I said, you know, Richard, I hear that you might have had something to do with the Hoffa hit. Is that true? He said, I don't want to talk about that. Very deadpan, this guy. And I said, you know, okay. He was not the kind of man. By the way, when I was interviewing him, I had to sit very close to him. Our knees were touching, and he's a huge man. I'm like, you know, 5'8½", and the way he was, I felt like I was a child talking to an adult. I felt very threatened by him, to tell you the truth. I never felt that way about Ramirez. But to get back to the Hoffa incident, so I kept bringing it up politely and asking about it, and he kept telling me he didn't want to talk to it. And after several weeks, he said to me, look, I'll tell you what happened, and I don't give a flying F what anyone thinks. I said, okay, fine, tell me. And he proceeded to tell me about his involvement in the murder of Jimmy Hoffa. And would you like me to tell your listeners quickly what it's about?
I got 30 seconds.
Well, he was made part of a hit team that went from Union City, Jersey, to Detroit, and he was the man that actually killed Hoffa. They burnt his body in the junkyard. The remains were buried. They were dug up later, put in the back of a car. The car was squashed, and it was sent with thousands of other cars of scrap metal to Japan. So I said, well, where do you think he is now? He said, I think he's part of a fender somewhere in Japan.
Wow. Wow. Unbelievable. Phil, I can imagine the nightmares you must have had after talking to this guy, but you've turned it into one heck of a book yet again.
Thanks a lot.
It is called The Iceman, Confessions of a Mafia Contract Killer. Philip Carlo. You can also find out more about what he's writing at his website, Philip with one L. PhilipCarlo.com is his website, and the book The Iceman, I think, is going to be another bestseller for you this summer, buddy.
Thanks a lot, pal. I so enjoyed doing your show. Anytime, Paul.
Thanks very much. Phil Carlo here on the Paul Harris Show. It's News Talk 1120 KMOX.